this episode of Outback Coroner.
When they made me coroner 15 years ago, I had to start thinking, well, why am I doing this?
Ben died of suspected arsenic poisoning.
You won't get closure on your grief until you know what happened.
Ben was in, he was in absolute agony.
Failure of his heart, lungs, liver, kidneys.
They thought he was just putting it on.
Ben remained a diagnostic puzzle.
You've got to restrain yourself.
Can we not get anybody to look at this kid?
Well, someone had to make a decision. Imagine a place as big as Western Europe with 200,000 people in it.
With a jurisdiction covering nearly 1.5 million square kilometres, the job of the Northern Territory coroner is uniquely demanding.
The challenges of isolation, distance. A suburban coroner in Melbourne might be dealing with swimming pool deaths. I'm dealing with children being taken by crocodiles and eaten alive. Refugees drowning. There's workplace accidents on stations. And to investigate those kind of deaths is difficult.
We've had instances of bodies decaying in police cells because there's no local mortuaries.
A controversial case that made headlines around the country has attracted the attention of the coroner.
Ben Whittam died of suspected arsenic poisoning.
The death of a 16-year-old on a cattle station that attracts tourists from around the world.
It started trickling back that maybe he died of arsenic poisoning, and that caused some fear about Mount Bundy, which I'd stayed at some years before, actually. A really nice, pretty place on the Adelaide River.
The Whittam family moved here from Western Australia 5 years ago.
When we took over Mount Bundy, we created a place for people to come and have a postcard view of a cattle property. We're very real Australians and in a very real Australian environment, so a lot of international guests love to come and just have a taste of what the real Northern Territory is about.
The Whittams' kids, 19-year-old Beck, 12-year-old Casey, and 16-year-old Ben, all part of the appeal.
He was a very big part of that business, and he had the real cowboy image, which everyone thought Australians should look like. I mean, he had the big buckle, the hat, the whole lot, and he put on this persona of a cowboy, and he was a real cowboy.
Love you.
Have a good day.
Morning, Vicky. Morning,
the
Alana.
Coroner will take Ben Whittam's case to inquest because it's not clear exactly how he died.
I investigate unexpected, unnatural and violent deaths on behalf of the community. The time, place and cause of death. The why, when, how.
Ben's family not only lost their son, but the mention of arsenic caused such public alarm they almost lost their property as well.
We're asking everybody to leave. That's the coroner's direction. We're abiding by that.
The question for the coroner is, what killed Ben? Was he poisoned or did the medical system fail him?
We're looking into the reasons for the termination of that life. The community sees that as important, and so it should. We want to know what happened.
The coroner aims to answer questions the Whittams have lived with for 18 months, since Ben died.
You ask yourself every day, what destroyed this fit young fella?
I didn't want to hear what happened and want to be part of it. Well, Scott maybe turns off and doesn't. I don't want to know about that. Mm. So we're different on that, but... Yeah.
Why is that, Scott?
It hurts.
It hurts?
Yeah. Yep.
It hurts.
Ben's inquest will take 3 days.
This is not a court case. It's my inquisition. It's my inquest. It's my inquiry. It's about vindicating Ben's life. That's what it's all about.
Coroner's Court of the Northern Territory is in session. Please be seated.
Miss Armitage, how are you?
Your Honour, I'm well. I call Dr. John Gilbert, Your Honour.
Will you promise to tell this court the truth?
Yes.
Good on you.
Dr. Gilbert, can you tell us what the provisional cause of death was?
He had a fungal infection that had spread throughout his body. As a consequence of that, he had failure of his heart, lungs, liver, kidneys and bone marrow, and that's collectively referred to as multi-organ failure.
That hurts. It's the last thing you want to hear is the bits and pieces of the insides of your child that's died. I mean, it's just not the nicest thing in the world, but...
Like any kid in the final year at school, Ben had his ups and downs, but the sickness that took him over just seemed to come out of nowhere.
It was early April. He did go out and do a bit of work on a property nearby, a day's work in the cattle yards, and he came back quite sick from that day.
His mother, Sue, thought it was Ross River virus, which is common in areas like subtropical Mount Bundy. It's carried by mosquitoes. If infected, the flu-like symptoms usually pass. But that isn't what happened with Ben. The closest clinic is at nearby Adelaide River, population 230. The doctor on duty ordered blood tests.
Blood tests seemed to confirm some kind of viral infection. Further blood tests were ordered.
While waiting for results, Ben just got sicker and sicker. At the clinic in Adelaide River, the decision was made to rush him 200 kilometres north to Darwin.
When we arrived, he'd lost a lot of his strength and he actually couldn't get out of the car. Ran around and found a wheelchair.
And then he just slowly went grey and downhill and just crashed before our eyes, pretty much.
In a coroner's court, I'm dealing with emotions. I'm dealing with grief. I'm dealing with love. I'm dealing with tears. I'm attracted to that kind of forum rather than some cold-blooded, adversarial forum where I'm generally putting people in jail.
He actually didn't fit in the paediatric beds. My feet hung over the edge.
How tall was he?
About 6'2".
Skinny bloke like me.
Yeah, like you.
What had happened to Ben? It didn't take the doctors in Darwin long to realise it was not just a virus that was making him so sick.
One of the doctors sort of took us aside and said, look, we think it's ALL, acute lymphoblastic leukaemia. We just sort of were blown away, we're holy hell, how does that happen?
Ben had been diagnosed with a cancer of the white blood cells, acute lymphoblastic leukaemia. Darwin Hospital wasn't equipped to deal with leukemia, so they made the radical decision to airlift him interstate, 3,000 kilometres, to the other end of the country.
He was considered to be critically unwell and suffering from a complicated constellation of symptoms and disorders. For a period, he was unexpectedly deeply comatose and his blood results indicated a recent heart attack.
Ben's condition was so extreme that the Adelaide doctors became increasingly perplexed.
I think at one stage we had 15 specialists standing at the end of his bed, every single specialist that they could pluck in to work out what the hell was going on.
And not to be able to pinpoint what was going on was just so scary.
In America, the coroner is a medico. We don't have that in our English form. We'd like to think we've got a broad-minded lawyer who brings in all the threads, including the medical cause of death, whilst looking at the wider circumstances.
The coroner wants to hear from all the doctors who treated Ben. There were lots of theories, but no obvious answers.
He arrived in what we call a state of multi-system failure.
Ben remained a diagnostic puzzle. The presentation was very unusual.
Sort of coagulopathy and a number of other medical problems as well.
HSV hepatitis. He'd been documented to have had a splenomegaly, recurrence of tumour lysis.
Tumour lysis syndrome.
The renal failure.
Septic shock due to infection.
The myocardial dysfunction, inferior ischemia. Those things are very unusual.
Various amongst really asked a lot of questions as to whether we were correct in making a diagnosis of acute lymphoblastic leukaemia.
So if it wasn't leukaemia, what was making Ben so sick?
One of the good things about being a trained lawyer and judicial officer is that you're trained to be objective, and I've got no agendas to run on this. We'll see what happens.
Make my own cup of tea. 21st century.
Yeah.
Yep. New age man. Got to make your own cup of tea.
I grew up in Melbourne, in Brunswick, which now is a gentrified inner suburban trendy place, but in the 60s it was almost embarrassing to say that you lived there. And Dad was a labourer and I drank too much.
Greg Kavanagh spent his youth playing Aussie rules football before graduating from law school 35 years ago. He's been a coroner for 15.
I used to hitchhike from Caulfield along Dandenong Road every morning to Monash Uni. I'd never heard swear words finished off with the pronunciation of ING. Fucking this and fucking that. And I'd never heard fucking, and I remember distinctly. I know it's funny, but it's true, thinking, what did that person say?
When he's not doing coronial work, Greg Kavanagh swaps duties and travels as a Northern Territory magistrate.
In some of the other states, the coroners have got so much work that they don't do the magistrate's work anymore. We haven't got the numbers.
The circuit takes Magistrate Kavanagh from the cities and towns along the Stuart Highway out to remote islands in the Torres Strait and to Aboriginal communities in the bush.
It's just flying the flag of the rule of law, going to the people instead of dragging them into Darwin. In the next couple of days, I'll be sending people to jail, I think. What's that cliche? But someone's got to do.
There's 49 defendants this morning today to be dealt with. Lots of aggravated assaults. Lots and lots. I'm sending people to jail where it's not going to make much difference.
Catherine Court of Summary Jurisdiction is now in session. May be seated.
Unfortunately, you get populist politicians peddling the myth that harsher sentencing cures crime. It doesn't. Charges of unlawfully caused serious harm and aggravated assault. One, assault police and fight in a public place in Alice Springs. Contravening a domestic violence order in Catherine this year on the 29th of the 11th. He's remanded in custody. The money I'm going to fine you today is better off with you for Christmas. You got children? Well, spend the money on them. Don't give it to the government.
Next stop, a bush community facing significant challenges.
The alcoholism is rampant. We've got to do something to protect the women from their drunken partners. You can't stop not sending out the message that picking up a star picket and bashing your wife after death is wrong. You get angry, you get upset, you go the biff. You've been to jail before, you've got to restrain yourself. People don't deserve to be slapped around like this, but to terrorise a woman in her own house is unacceptable.
But I'm not sure jail is going to cure anything in that regard, except perhaps to give some short-term protection whilst the perpetrator's in jail.
You have a few drinks, you don't go near her. Just 6 weeks imprisonment.
I think the government are on track with rehabilitation measures for alcoholics. But the tyranny of distance and the isolation factors work against that. And it's very difficult and costly. It can be soul-destroying.
There's only one jail on the top end. It's got some pretty evil people in it. You don't want to go there for this kind of behaviour. Well, wake up to yourself, OK?
Guilty.
Guilty? Cheerio. Happy Christmas.
Things will get better, but it's slow.
Greg Kavanagh will do 12 trips like this each year.
If all I had to do was be a magistrate in the Northern Territory on circuit, I wouldn't have lasted. The coronial jurisdiction gives me the ability to make a difference in terms of recommendations, comments, and helping the community. I'd much rather be doing that than putting blackfellas in jail.
3,000 kilometres from home, Ben Whittam fought on. In the space of 2 weeks, he'd gone from suspected viral infection to constant watch in intensive care. Fed through tubes, he would stabilise briefly, then relapse into coma.
He was in intensive care in Adelaide.
Yep.
I think for about 17 days, is that right?
I've got all sorts of notes here that I sort of kept over that time. He just had that many ups and that many downs. That it's very hard to keep track of after, you know, 4 weeks sitting by his bedside, you know, 23 hours a day.
The family are very interested to know, was he given proper attention and treatment? I suspect there'll be some areas of concern about communication between medical professionals and families.
While leukemia was uncertain, it was still considered the most likely diagnosis. And as he was too sick for chemotherapy, steroids were prescribed, which gave Ben a boost.
Well, the thing with steroids is that it does boost your body as well, so it sort of gave him a bit of a chance to pick up.
Yeah, I remember we watched footy together and in my mind, you know, things look fantastic. And so I decided to come home on that Monday.
The steroids that had boosted Ben gave his father hope. Scott had a cattle station to run and 150 visitors to look after. But in truth, Ben's problems were only just beginning. Within 24 hours of leaving intensive care, he started to complain of extreme abdominal pain.
He was screaming in pain. He was screaming at me to get the nurses. He said, "Mum, Mum, Mum, get someone, get someone." Sorry.
There was no immediate explanation as to why Ben was in such agony. His mother demanded action, but it was not forthcoming.
And to see your child go through that sort of pain, it was like third world country. Is anyone listening? They thought he was just putting it on. I'm sure they just thought that this kid was putting on. I said, this kid does not put on pain, you know, he's tough as.
I mean, I can see their faces. And for them to have the courage to get in the witness box and relive that month, wow. I've got one son like them, and he's 17. He's that guy in that picture up there. My 6'8", rugby-playing, beautiful boy, Joseph. And if he died the way that their son had died, I would be a tearful mess. And I said to them that if I teared up on the bench, I wanted them to know that it was genuine.
At Mount Bundy, Scott waited for news.
The Wednesday before the significant crash, he actually spoke to him on the phone. And that was pretty well the last words. And he said, "I love you, Dad."
In intensive care, Ben was so distressed that senior consulting oncologist Dr. Tomáš Revez was called in from a social function to examine him.
Would you promise to tell us the truth, please?
Promise to tell the truth.
Thanks.
I think it was about midnight, he turned up for a look. He was in his tuxedo, all dressed up, and obviously been out the town. He was on call. He stood over Ben's bed with his hands like this and just looked at him like this and said, like this, and wouldn't touch him, wouldn't feel his belly.
So would you agree that you made no physical examination of Ben yourself?
They're probably right. It may have been that he was just settled down at the time and I wouldn't have wanted to wake him up. I don't always examine the patients when I do rounds on the ward. In certain situations, you rely on the assessment of your juniors.
I find that I see parents who hear, sometimes for the first time, what doctors did and what they felt.
Were you the doctor in the tuxedo?
Yes.
The decision was made to give Ben morphine with a button that allows self-administration.
He was in no state to push any buttons, so they suggested that we push the button for him. And I said, well, how do we know when we're going to push the button? He's screaming in pain constantly. We can't just keep pushing the button and hope it goes away.
No one was trying to find out the source of her son's pain. Sue Whittam asked for an X-ray to see what was wrong.
You didn't suggest if the pain persisted that perhaps they should, one, either X-ray or two, seek surgical advice?
I think we talked about it, but I said we will see how it goes.
A bit of a wait and see. We'll wait and see how this progresses.
Yes.
And a couple of times he could have cut the ear with a knife. You get used to quite some defensiveness. And for me personally, I was pleasantly surprised by the frankness and honesty of the medicos.
All Sue could do was comfort her son.
Well, we stayed up all night with him, obviously, and I talked him through a lot of the pain. We went through every single horse's name on our property. Every single gate on the property, you know, where's this gate, where's this gate, just to try and talk him through the pain. So, a very long night.
Ben's pain had gradually increased for a period of nearly 17 hours. Sue thought there had been some perforation of his stomach.
Were you at all concerned that he had been left groaning in pain and distressed with a pain score 9 out of 10 in spite of the morphine that had been ordered?
Of course I have.
And would you agree that those symptoms are consistent with a severe abdominal condition, a possible perforation?
Yes, they are compatible.
And
they can also be a sign of other abdominal pathology.
It was 9 a.m. the following morning that the hospital finally decided to order a CT scan. As Sue had suspected, they found a tear in the stomach wall. The surgeon on duty was Dr. Goh.
When there is a perforation, what occurs internally?
There is literally a hole in the stomach. There's free flow of stomach contents, which contains bile, blood, acids, bacteria, undigested food, which is what we found in Ben, through the entire abdominal cavity. And that, in itself, can be a life-threatening situation.
Ben was in trouble and was rushed into surgery.
And one of the doctors came rushing out and said, we have no idea what we're in for when we get in there. He's probably not going to survive. No one faked him in the wing and said, it's all going to be OK. They said, look, we're going to do the best we can, sign this form. We'll let you know when he comes out.
The steroid treatment that had boosted him had compromised the lining of his stomach, which contributed to the tear. The surgeons sewed it up as best they could.
Did he recover from that?
He did for a little while. He opened his eyes was awake for a whole night, like on the ventilator, but awake and looking around, and he was actually quite awake.
The upturn in Ben's condition was short-lived. Within days, his pallor and physical condition changed dramatically.
5:52, I've got looks like an Ethiopian. His feet and hands are swollen, he's got no muscle tone, his feet are going black again, worse than ever.
The leakage from the hole in his stomach had allowed a fungal infection to take hold in his gut.
I've seen the photographs of the boy. He was a skinny, blackened mess. He looked awful.
The fungal infection was the last straw. Ben never recovered.
And that's when Scott flew back.
Yeah.
And Rebecca and Amber.
So I think the life supports were maintained.
Yeah.
Until family could arrive.
Yeah, that's right.
Ben died on May the 24th, 2011, 5 weeks after falling ill.
The death of their loved one is very important to them, but it's also very important to us as a community. The death of any one of us is a death of part of the community. And the community, through the coroner, wants to know what happened.
The question for the coroner is, did the delay in diagnosing the perforation contribute to Ben's death?
But whether it is fair to say that his prognosis was adversarially affected by that delay, I honestly can't tell you. I'm not trying to defend myself. I'm just trying to say that, look, it's terrible, and I feel very, very sorry for Ben. I feel sorry for the family, and I feel terrible as a physician. But it does not mean that event was what killed poor Ben.
In the top end, people live side by side with man-eaters.
What would the Northern Territory be without the NT News and a crocodile headline? I always felt really badly about the German tourist who was taken by a crocodile. Tourist guide, supposedly experienced, lets them go for a swim in one of the billabongs in Kakadu. And the autopsy has revealed that the deceased died from drowning, which means she was probably alive in the mouth of the crocodile. Imagine the terror to be in that situation under the water in the moments before you die. I also did an inquest on her. The tour leader got charged with criminal negligence.
It's not just the crocodiles. There are many bizarre deaths up here, and most end up in the pages of the Northern Territory News.
The local gossip sheet, read by most of the voters in Darwin. They follow me around a fair bit, I suppose. The young reporter from the NT News wants to do a story about suicides, which is pretty topical at the moment around Australia.
Megan.
Hello, how are you?
I'm okay for an old bloke.
Wedding photo?
Yeah.
Very nice.
I'm a lucky bloke. She tells me all the time.
Good on her.
Just get you to look straight into the camera for me.
Great. I think it's good for the community to face the issue, which has often in the past been hidden somewhat because it's seen to have been an embarrassment to loving families.
The youth suicide rate in the Territory is 3.5 times higher than the national average. What is it about the Territory that you think makes those numbers so high?
It's a worry. And what do I think about the answers? Kids need mentoring. They usually need more than mum and dad. They need friendship. They need direction. In my life, it was my football coach when I was 16. You need that. You need that extra help to hold your hand to get through some pretty traumatic years. Excuse me, I'm in demand today. G'day, Kathy. I'm good. I'm being interviewed at the moment by the NT News about suicides. How's your lovely baby? Cheers, love. Bye. That's the deputy coroner who's on maternity leave. I just said I'd rather see this kind of article than another crocodile story.
When Ben Whittam died, a couple of weeks short of his 17th birthday at the Adelaide Children's Hospital, his family thought their nightmare might be coming to an end. But the very next day, things took an unexpected turn. The late return of one of Ben's urine samples indicated arsenic levels 14 times higher than normal. It seemed he'd been poisoned. But how?
But I was very concerned that it was a genuine result. Because the clinical picture that Ben had presented with was very consistent with arsenic poisoning. Bone marrow failure, encephalopathy, kidney failure, the inflammation in his heart.
All of these are classic symptoms of arsenic poisoning.
The first anyone knew up here about this young man dying of arsenic poisoning was really the front page of the NT News.
The Northern Territory teenager died from arsenic poisoning and it
it had got from the hospital in Adelaide to the NT News.
The news that Ben may have been poisoned spread like wildfire. The clinic near Mount Bundy received a phone call from Adelaide to alert them to the high arsenic reading. In response, they immediately took blood and urine tests from seven residents in and around the station. Local GP Dr. Fonda analysed the findings.
What did you see at that time?
I received eight people's results and I saw that seven of them appeared to be abnormal.
I remember the police coming out to my home on that weekend. Government departments had indicated that they weren't the responsible department to close the station, and what are you going to do about it, Mr. Kavanagh?
Well, someone had to make a decision, and I did.
140 people were staying on Mount Bundy that night. Backpackers and travellers from all over Australia and all over the world, sound asleep when the police arrived.
They ended up arriving at about 1 a.m. on the Sunday. Went around and woke everyone up and gave them the option to either stay or leave.
So don't drink the tap water, and here, have a bottle of water in case you need a drink.
Sort of by 10:30, everyone was gone.
Is that?
What is that?
That's the notice the police put all around Mount Bundy Station, declaration of a disaster under the Coroner's Act. For the first time in 15 years, I used my powers under the Coroner's Act to close down the station for 3 or 4 days.
All of this happened while the Whittams were in Western Australia. They had gone there to bury Ben, near where Scott and Sue had grown up. Sue returned to find herself locked out of her own property.
So I came back to police guards at the gate, not being able to get into the office and sort out the mess that was going on, so I was just running completely on mobile phone. I was getting phone calls saying, I want to cancel my booking for such and such. I probably had 20, 30 phone calls within 2 days. Please cancel our booking, please cancel our booking. You've got arsenic, please cancel our booking.
Roger Potts has been on Mount Bundy for 14 years. He was living there when the Whittams first arrived. He works as an environmentalist in the mining industry.
I came back the next morning to assist the police, water sampling all the water holes, known water locations throughout the property, billabongs, the taps, all the different houses, just to get an insight as to what the levels were, if there was any location that was elevated. It's one of those things like cyanide people don't understand. It's just a word that creates fear and panic.
Arsenic is a naturally occurring element, so traces of it were found in the water supply. And when this news was combined with the elevated levels detected in the seven people from Mount Bundy, it seemed the evidence was indisputable.
What did you make of that?
Well, my partner drinks more than all the cows put together, and she had the lowest levels of us all, so that didn't make sense to start off with. I couldn't see it being arsenic.
by this stage. The whole town was in absolute panic, thinking that there's arsenic at Mount Bundy Station, and are they drinking the same water? We've all got the same aquifer, we're all drinking the same water. A lot of families saying, oh, my children are sick, they must have arsenic, you know, and started blaming us for having an arsenic source.
We had, at that stage, up to 14 times a deadly amount of arsenic, apparently, in his urine. It's an old cliche, better safe than sorry.
Once the arsenic reading first became known, Scott Whittam received a call from the South Australian Coroner's Office.
He rang me and he said, we're required to do an autopsy on Ben. And I said, you know, like buggery, you just have a look at his body, what's been done to him.
By law, the body of a deceased person is the property of the coroner. Until released, he has the right to order autopsy.
Obviously, I was very sorry to hear that the family was distressed. I gave some anxious consideration to what they had to say there.
And I said, there's no way in the world.
Bloody leave him alone. He's gone. For God's sake, just leave him alone.
I came to the conclusion that the reported presence of something as sinister as arsenic in Ben's urine was something that had to be investigated as thoroughly as it could be.
And he rang back and said, yeah, sorry, you've been overruled. We're going to go ahead with the autopsy. And it's our family, our kid, and then...
All of a sudden, that's taken away from you. He's still part of our family. We still had to bury him. We still had all those things to go through. And all of a sudden, he becomes their property.
And then, out of the blue, a shocking revelation. When local GP Dr. Fonda double-checked his Mount Bundy arsenic tests.
And at that moment, as soon as my eyes saw the result, I actually saw the mistake that had been made in the interpretation.
Analysing arsenic requires the skills of a specialist. The doctor had misread the measurement scales and misdiagnosed the arsenic levels in the seven people from Bundy that he tested.
I was quite impressed with the doctor, who was not disingenuous, was entirely truthful, you would think, who said, look, I am not used to interpreting arsenic results, and it was all, apparently, a mistake. It's all coming out. That's what we do in terms of an inquest. Let's put it all on the table. What happened?
You know, the whole thing for me, it's about Ben. I'm dealing with Ben's death. And then you've got all this bloody, as it turns out, rubbish and switch hunt that went on about the arsenic. It shouldn't have been that way, but it is. But just the massive impact that's had on us is just for nothing.
I regret the fact that the information I had at the time wasn't, as it turned out, correct. But I'd still make the same decision.
After further analysis, the arsenic in the water on Mount Bundy was in fact found to be in the safe range.
We got a heavy water expert called in, and it turned out that the arsenic limits were unusual but not all that dangerous.
So why was the reading in Ben's original urine sample so high?
Doctor, you're the one that called for arsenic to be looked at as a possible contributor to the illness of this boy. That's right, isn't it?
Yes.
Now, your evidence, I think, leaves me with an impression that you still think that maybe that was a genuine result and that, in fact, arsenic poisoning may well have contributed to his death. Am I right in that impression?
Yes.
To find out the truth about the amount of arsenic in Ben Whittam's body required the assistance of a world-renowned expert.
Arsenic then is a systemic poison. It works as a corrosive. Well, I've investigated a number of cases of proposed arsenic poisoning in the past. This seemed a possibility from the start, given the clinical features of the deceased prior to his passing. What other signs might you look for with arsenic poisoning?
Things like seizures, changes in their level of consciousness.
The heart's working harder.
Arsenic poisoning is, of course, emotive. It carries with it a certain cachet. But it's also incredibly rare.
Do you believe that arsenic was involved in any way in Ben's death?
The diagnosis of arsenic poisoning is a complex clinical diagnosis to make.
A one-off test reveals little. To determine arsenic poisoning properly, it needs to be measured over time and patterned.
Some of the features might fit with arsenic poisoning, but every sample that was taken on Ben Whittam, either ante-mortem or post-mortem, barring one, was negative for arsenic. I think the diagnosis of arsenic poisoning is, in my professional opinion, extremely unlikely.
Before the inquest concludes, witnesses from police and Northern Territory Health give their version of events.
What happens now? We go away. We'll draft up a set of findings and deliver them in several weeks' time. Will adjourn sine die?
Stand. Coroner's Court of the Northern Territory now stands adjourned.
Really draining at the end, hearing all those facts and stuff, and it kind of goes out of, like, over your head a little bit, and then you walk outside and you're just like, holy moly.
Look, I'm a bit tired. Takes a bit out of you. The emotion was evident in the last two or three days. I don't know how they sat through that. If that had been my son, I would be an absolute mess.
I think it was really good for them to know that there was nothing they could have done. Not even the people who were meant to know knew, so it's taken a bit of, I don't know, maybe guilt away.
To air it all again, to have it all out in the open again, was probably a good healing thing for both of us to do, because otherwise you sort of put it in the corner and say, oh, I don't want to deal with that, that hurts too much, because we had to actually do it. Was probably a good thing for us, yeah.
Good morning, Coroner's Office. Vicky speaking.
Vicky, did you want me to sign something, love?
Medical authorities, please.
When did this person die?
In his 15 years as coroner, Greg Kavanagh has seen his fair share of tragedy.
Direction for an autopsy.
Thanks, yeah.
Fair bit of death last night.
There was.
So how do you cope? You need really good staff. The staff here are great. What court are we in?
Court 3.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Let's go.
There's a couple of emotional and taxing inquiries coming up. There's a father who suicided and after killing his two little kids.
I think the way I've coped the last several years is having a great partner. Go home, you switch off. G'day, princess. How are you? You gonna pick me up?
Flame trees come out this time of the year. Isn't that magnificent?
And to come home to this kind of garden, you know, I've planted everything there. It's all about balance, isn't it? Misery and death and putting people in jail, and you come home to something like this, which is just, it's all you need. It's all you need. And a glass of red, but it's early, so I'll have a cup of tea.
I wouldn't like the general populace to know where I live. Security can be an issue. I handle a lot of controversial cases. I'd have put several people in jail. I'm pleased that when I go down the street, I get a lot of thank yous, a couple of murmurings of abuse, but most of it's good. Got to be a bit careful when I go out on a Friday night as to what pub I go to, I suppose, and I am.
There she is. There's the princess.
Hi, Ronnie.
Good morning, how are
morning.
You? All well?
When I go home, Ronnie says, you never talk about your cases. Oh, I don't want to. Ronnie's the head charang of all the Qantas hosties here. There's about 50. She's a mother hen.
much rather talk about her work.
That's lovely, Artie.
I can see the Qantas planes come in. And I know whether Ronnie's early or late.
Ronnie's in, so he comes and starts the car. It takes 10 minutes and he's there to pick me up after work.
Everyone calls you Your Honour. You get on this first and second page of that local news all the time. It's easy to think you're more important than you are, and Darwin doesn't let me do that.
I wouldn't trade it.
The coroner takes his time to complete his findings. He knows so much hangs in the balance.
I'm not out for revenge or anything like that, but someone's obviously done the wrong thing and we've lost our son out of it.
The next set of findings is to do with the inquest that was held into the death of Ben Witham. I see his parents are here. Thank you for coming. I'm going to formally hand them down. I think they're self-explanatory. They're the story of the death of your son.
Ben James Witham, born on the 7th of May 1994. The deceased resided at Mount Bundy Station, Adelaide River in the Northern Territory of Australia. I find that Ben did not die from arsenic poisoning, nor did arsenic contribute to his death. I further find that the single urine sample that returned an elevated reading was either contaminated or was in error. The cause of death was multi-organ failure with terminal fungal sepsis on a background of acute leukemia. A contributing cause of death was gastric perforation on the 13th of May 2011.
It's the delay in dealing with Ben's stomach perforation that lies at the heart of Scott and Sue's concerns. Should Dr. Revesz have ordered a CT scan sooner?
I feel terrible as a physician, but it does not mean that event was what killed poor Ben.
The missed diagnosis and subsequent failure in care rose from a wrong clinical decision on one occasion by Dr. Revesz. Save for one significant incident, I find Ben's care to be reasonable and appropriate. Accordingly, I find, as a result of evidence adduced at the public inquest, that no recommendations arise from this inquest.
Put yourself in their hands, you're at their mercy. I mean, stuff does happen in hospital, we know that, but
yeah.
And they're only human. But he was in a position to do something about it and didn't. He had no excuse for what he didn't do, apart from not doing it, making the wrong decision.
While the coroner found no one directly accountable for Ben's death, systemic changes were undertaken in both Darwin and Adelaide health services.
They've put procedures into place where that'll never happen again. But, yeah, we'll pray for them. Doesn't help us, does it?
They mightn't go away completely happy or satisfied, but they've had, to use a cliche, their day in court. They've had the doctors answer questions. They've seen the process and how it operates. They're able to realise why things were done. And if for no other reason, one of the good reasons for an inquest is for that to happen.
His round continues. Over the next year, Coroner Greg Kavanagh will spend half his time on the road.
I still get a buzz going to work. I feel like I'm doing something for the community. I don't want to do anything else but be a good coroner. That might sound a bit daggy, but there you go.